Law Focus Podcast. Bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
Welcome to Law Focus, the show with the staunch focus on the law. My name is Basil Sharinda, your voice of law for the evening. On this legal bench of Law Focus this evening, we are discussing the very predicaments that hit at the heart of the pandemic of absent fathers, and that is child maintenance. By the way, Law Focus listener, the Human Sciences Research Council and the South African Race Relations Institute have conducted a study for the past 5 years, and they found that actually about 60% of South African children have absent fathers, and mind you, 40% of South African mothers are single mothers. Now, that circumstance in and of itself necessitates the institution and administration of child maintenance. Tonight's mandate on Law Focus is underpinned by the recent passing into law of the Maintenance Amendment Act 2015. Now, the first question that one asks themselves in this instance is, what constitutes maintenance? What kind of legislation do we have in place to regulate that area? And what happens to anyone who fails to pay maintenance? Now, according to legislation, a child is entitled to maintenance for clothes, housing, dental and medical care, education and training, to the extent that whatever parent that is being impugned can afford. Now, in some instances, some parents cannot afford that far. Now, Law Focus listener, between me and you, we know that we are talking about fathers here, because it's hardly ever the case that mothers have to pay child maintenance. So humor me, let's look at the demographics of South Africa. Looking at 60% of fathers that are absent, chances are mothers who are flooding the maintenance offices are trying to sue these fathers to pay for child maintenance. And so this is how it works in the country. For a maintenance officer to know how much a father can afford to pay in maintenance, they look at how much they earn, they look at how much they spend, exactly how a credit regulator would look, or maybe rather a credit giver would look at before they give you credit. And some fathers actually lie. And so the old legislation, or the legislation that was in place before 2015, before it was amended, did not have regulations as to how that could be deterred. And so in 2015, the Maintenance Amendment Act number 9 of that year was passed. And this act tries to curb ways, in essence, and which is going to mask the discussion for the evening, is that this Maintenance Act actually blacklists fathers who do not pay maintenance, who default on their maintenance, right? And so now, one of the other things that happens, Law Focus listener, is that the maintenance officer can actually issue an order to the employer of the father to pay in debit orders. Now, please do look forward to this child maintenance discussion. Later on in the show, we'll be speaking to the Department of Justice. We'll also speak to a couple of lawyers to hear their view on whether this legislation is progressive or regressive. Please stay tuned. And these are the legal hotspots for the week. As always, we start with these top stories of the week.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week is Legal Hotspots.
Welcome back to Law Focus. For the legal hotspots of the week, we have a couple of stories, and one of the major stories is that in Australia, it has been found out by the World Health Organization that they've exported listeria-tainted watermelons to 9 countries. And by the way, the Corruption Watch has released a report that people have actually given complaints of up to 5,000 in 2017. We'll be looking into that story. The second story that we're looking at is the indictment that which has been released against President Jacob Zuma for his charge on corruption and fraud. And I understand that is probably one of the most interesting stories for you and I. The latest story would be the story on ICASA. So the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa has announced that it will be looking into anti-competitive conduct in the pay TV market. That is your DSTVs and so forth. But far more interesting is that the previous chairperson of ICASA, having been in office for like probably a year or so, has been convicted and is being sentenced for money laundering and fraud and corruption. Now, those are going to be the interesting stories of the week. But what seems to interest me and probably interest you more is that having seen how listeriosis has broken out in South Africa in the past 2 weeks or so, and we've seen how many people have died. It has claimed over 900 lives, and so there's been a lawsuit that which has been launched against Tiger Brands, and they're probably trying to deny liability there. But we'll see how those settlement claims go, if it will go as far as litigation, or whether they will settle out of court and they will admit liability and probably issue an apology of some sort to the public. But I mean, looking at that, in Australia they've exported watermelons to 9 countries, right? And these watermelons were contaminated with this deadly listeriosis bacteria. And this outbreak has killed over 7 people already and has caused a miscarriage, that is a spontaneous abortion. I mean, this is horrific. It's scary for anyone to understand that they've exported this to 9 countries. How many other countries have they exported it to? We only know about these 9 countries thus far because it has been spotted. And now we know that Tiger Brands had this particular deadly disease, and they didn't even know where it came from, or so they claim. But anyway, so Corruption Watch has reported that people have complained over 5,000 corruption reports in 2017. And so they've released this report, and they titled it that the time is now. And so they try to paint a picture of a more emboldened and vocal public. And they say that in actual fact, there's a 25% increase in the number of reports or complaints of corruption, and that the range of interventions undertaken by the Corruption Watch team have been miraculous. Now, what is to be noted from this situation is that they're trying to create a public trust of some sort out of us into how they're looking into corruption. I mean, the specialized commercial courts have been actually busy. I mean, to know that they've been busy, your president, Jacob Zuma, there's been an indictment that has been released against him by the National Prosecuting Authority, since we're speaking about corruption. He's also being charged with money laundering. He's being charged with a count of racketeering. He's being charged with corruption, that money laundering, 12 counts of fraud. And along with sales, he's also being charged with 1 count of racketeering, corruption, and money laundering as well. And this matter has been postponed for hearing at the Devon High Court to June 8, 2018. Now, this indictment says this, that they show an instance where Nkobi obtained the assistance of Jacob Zuma for the group survival. That is so that Jacob Zuma can provide them with political protection in the ANC. And so he has relieved monies over 500,000, monies over 1 million rand, and many others that which one needs to note. But this indictment by the National Prosecuting Authority also state that there is an illegal common purpose relationship between Zuma and his convicted financial and advisor, Shabir Sheikh. Now, and also the French-owned arms dealer, Thales South Africa, to pay and accept bribes for political protection, as I was saying to you. And this document is over 89 pages. So let's see how that gets to be prosecuted in court, and which counts get to be proven before the court beyond a reasonable doubt. As you know, it's a criminal case, so it has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That is the evidence that which has to be produced by the National Prosecuting Authority. Now, for the final story, ICASA states that it also wants to address anti-competitive conduct in their pay TV market. They will be proceeding with oral hearings, which will commence in a couple of weeks from now. And so this has been a long-awaited probe into this anti-competitive conduct by many South Africans, including me and you, Law Focus listener. And they say that they want to look into how Multi-Choice has gotten exclusive rights into sports. They got exclusive rights into certain shows that which the SABC cannot broadcast. They've gotten into price fixing and cartels with the SABC to try and kill other businesses. But I mean, thus far there are still allegations, and we'll see how these oral proceedings go. But so far they have over 18 submissions. And Multi-Choice has actually released a 60-page submission. So it's about to be very interesting, because it commences on the 7th of May. It has to be remembered that Multi-Choice was also impugned and accused by the Democratic Alliance to have been involved in a 100 million rand plan to influence digital migration with the SABC. Now, that's corruption, that's fraud, that's that's illegality in its entirety. But while that is happening, the previous chairperson of ICASA is being sentenced for conviction on fraud and corruption. And so it becomes clear that life goes on, Mr. Mahlaloga, and he will be sentenced to over 15 years in prison and also certain monies that he has to pay back. And those are the legal hotspots for this week.
Top stories of the week. It's Legal Hotspots.
Welcome back, and we're still discussing Maintenance Act changes. And we will later on be speaking to Ms. Joy van der Heide. And she wrote a very interesting paper where she speaks about how justice delayed is justice denied. We are going to speak about that paper when we return from the ad break.
Law Focus, handing you your rights.
Welcome back to Law Focus, and you're still sitting with Basil Sherinda, and I'm your voice of law for the evening. Welcome. So we're still discussing the Maintenance Act and the changes that which it has brought in its amendment in 2015. And on the line, we have Ms. Joy van der Heide, who is a practicing attorney in this area. Oh, we have, we'll be speaking to Ms. Joy van der Heide later. But right now, we're speaking to Ms. Petra Josephine from the Department of Justice. Ms. Josephine, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and a very good evening to the listeners as well.
You know, it's a very good evening, but far more interesting, it's the changes that which the Maintenance Amendment Act brought to the maintenance area. Can you please take us through what is the effect of these changes, or what are these changes to start to begin with?
Okay, to begin with, the first one is that the Maintenance Act has actually opened up in terms of the jurisdiction. What it now provides is that a person who wants to apply for maintenance does no longer have to necessarily apply at the place where they are currently residing. Yeah. However, they can apply at the place where they are actually employed. Number two, it also speaks about the court's powers. There's now, strengthening the court's powers in terms of the court now being able to issue directives or to issue court orders to these electronic service providers to actually provide the details or the contact details of the maintenance defaulters. Like, for example, if you've been traced and then we are unable to actually get, hold of you, then the maintenance court can actually issue a directive to say to the service providers, please provide us with the details in terms of which this person has actually registered their cell phone in terms of the VICA Act. And certainly now it speaks to the issue of the prison term to say if you are found guilty of having violated the court order, which is the maintenance order, you are now going to be eligible to go to court for a period of 3 years and no longer 1 year, as opposed to the then provisions of the Maintenance Act. And the last one deals with the issue of blacklisting,
the interesting one.
Of the maintenance default. Yes. That one to say that, remember that one has to do with, a successful application for the enforcement of a maintenance order to say, a maintenance order has to first be issued against the defaulter, and then the person then has to then now default in terms of, complying with that order. After they have defaulted, then you have to then go back to the court and then, apply for an enforcement, order. And once then it is now, approved, then we'll then be able to say, yes, you are now a defaulter, and you're even also going to be listed also on the systems at the Department of Justice. And secondly, your name is going to be referred to, the credit listers, wherein you'll no longer be able to get credit, and some can even be affected in terms of the area of their work. Like, for example, with the attorneys, you may be struck off the roll in the case that you have found that you are blacklisted. And with the bank's officials as well, you may not even find a job in the banking industry. So those are actually the four main priority areas in terms of the amendment.
So now I understand that. So should that person default on their maintenance order? Let's get to the meaty of it. It is lawful to hand over their personal information to the credit bureau. I understand that aspect, and I also understand that. So that may mean that to prevent any further credit to be granted to this person, it means that there needs to be an order that that their information has to be handed over to the court. I understand that aspect.
Correct.
Am I correct?
Correct.
Now, who pays for these services?
You know, the services, you know, are being paid by the state for now, as prescribed in terms of the regulations to the Maintenance Act. However, they are going to be recovered from the defaulter themselves at a later stage. Now, remember, we don't want to burden the maintenance complainants because, you know, they are already being burdened by the fact that they are not receiving, you know, like one's contribution to the maintenance of the child.
You know, Ms. Jeffers Josephine, now that you're mentioning that at a later stage it will be claimed from the defaulters, one of the worries of maintenance lawyers is that should the defaulter be burdened with this maintenance cost and also the credit bureau and also the blacklisting, that may mean that they will be in a worse off financial position. Now, how will that affect the child that is supposed to be receiving this money from this person in the first place?
You know what? This particular aspect, you know, comes into play, especially as a, you know, like a deterrent measure, and also, you know, sort of to actually, you know, punish those that actually stay away from their maintenance obligation. Because remember, in South Africa as it is, we are having this particular social issue wherein we have sort of commercialized maintenance. People think that, you know, you must just throw money at the child and that's it. They forget about the, you know, like the bigger picture relating to the parental responsibilities and rights. To say over and above contributing to the maintenance, you must also cultivate a relationship with the child. So this is just actually to say to you guys that, you know what, this is a red alert, this is Amber, you are about to get into trouble. And in order for you to get into trouble, comply so that you don't find yourself in that particular scenario. However, remember, South Africa is a democratic society, it's a democratic state. And, you know, it's subject to their right, because remember, it will not be granted willingly. It's still subject to Section 35 of the Constitution, where you are still eligible to appear before the court and oppose that particular, you know, like process as well. It doesn't mean that it's going to be done behind your back. It is an open process.
I'm still worried. I'm worried about now in a situation where you still have a parent, and I understand that mostly they are fathers, but for gender purposes, let me rather say, you still have a parent who still defaults nonetheless. And when they default on this payment, they still find themselves in a worse position. Now, how do we tackle that kind of issue? Because now the child is missing out.
You know what? I love the South African law. South African law is very broad, you know, and you know, it's, you know, we have very good mechanisms. Remember, you can, you know, apply for, you know, for a particular order to be certified, to be rescinded, you know, after that has been done to you. And again, and I'm still, you know, like going back to the issue of saying that this is not that it is going to be done behind one's back. You still have this particular, you know, right to actually appear before the court and oppose that particular issue. Because remember, before those particular orders are issued, they are actually subject to both parties still appearing before the maintenance officer, wherein we will try to mediate between them. Because remember, we do not want to actually pardon this particular child, because, for example, what I've picked up is that as a maintenance complaint officer, that I've picked up that most parents actually want to go the route of actually enforcing the maintenance orders from the criminal aspect of things, you know, saying that, you know, I want to punish this person, I want them to be jailed and all that, but not knowing that, yes, the person can go to jail and they may lose their job and this child will find themselves in a worse
position,
case, you know, like scenario. However, and parents don't know that, because remember, at the time, they are actually, you know, concentrating mostly on their hate, their anger, and the betrayal and everything, but they are forgetting the bigger picture, which is the child. However, all these processes are subject to, you know, like the other laws, which is, you know, like laws relating to the court processes, wherein one can rescind, one can get that court order varied, one can get that particular court order set aside, and, you know, like, and that can actually reverse the particular situation that actually happened to them. And remember also, the National Credit Act also is broad in terms of providing the requirements before one can be blacklisted. You know, before you can actually do that, you need to comply with that 20 days notice to say that before you blacklist, you must give the very same defaulter notice to say, hey, we are about to, you know, like hand over your details to the listers, and what do you have to say for yourself? And you can have that particular chance of 20 working days to then rectify that particular situation. So it is a very fair process, for, you know, like in my own personal view.
True indeed. So in instances where some fathers probably lie about how much they earn, what measures are in place to actually verify this process and make it stricter?
You know, over and above, you know, like the system that we use within the department of tracing the asset and tracing the whereabouts of the individuals, we also have, you know, like the maintenance investigators who actually go into that particular, you know, like process of checking that. And but remember, that is also subject to the POPI Act as well, because you cannot just go into people's assets and all that. But remember, each and every case needs to be looked at in accordance with its particular merits.
So can the property of the defaulting father be attached in the event of insolvency?
Yes. You know, like there was a recent constitutional case where, you know, like a father's house was actually sold because they were in areas of about 300,000 rands, and you know, like in as much as it was said, the court had to go into the merits of the case. They zoomed in and they found that the father was actually deliberately, you know, like withdrawing maintenance because he wanted to punish the mother of the child. And the court basically frowned upon that particular conduct, because at the end of the day, the court just said, you know, it is this child's right, you know, to maintenance, and it is both parents' joint obligation to maintain this child. And now you cannot just walk away and start, you know, like engaging into your own parental conflict and forgetting the child. And because of that, that particular property was declared specially executable and is going to be sold, and whatever proceeds are going to be obtained, they are going to be, you know, like paid towards the area maintenance. That is said, but you know, that is just to say, parents, let's go back to the drawing board and parent the child. And remember, the things that actually causes parents to actually go to the court, and which I actually tend to say, you know, it's better for parents to sit down and have a conversation about the child than to go to the court. It's simply because parents refuse to parent. They fail to understand that parenting is not, you know, in as much as money makes the world go round, but parenting has more to do with the parents, you know, like supporting and promoting your social, economical, you know, like intellectual, psychological and emotional well-being of the child from infancy to adulthood, you know, and money is going to enhance that. But let's be there as parents, because, you know, if the other parents can see that you are actually trying, you know, you are picking the child, you know, at school, you know, you are assisting the child with homework, you are there in the child's life, what would there be, you know, what need will then necessitate them to then go to court and start with this, you know, like adversarial and litigious processes?
Yeah, well, eloquently put. So when were the proclamations released for this bill to come into, for this act to come into implementation?
You know, the president signed that off, the actual president signed that off in 2015. However, the specific, you know, amendment which I was now alluding to came into operation on the 5th of January 2018.
Oh, okay. We hope that it goes well. Ms. Peta Josephine, I would like to go further and have this discussion, but unfortunately, I have to thank you for your contribution this evening.
It's a pleasure. Anytime, you may contact me whenever you need to actually get clarity as well on other issues, because I believe that you know, as South Africa, we need to actually move forward to actually turning information into knowledge.
Thank you very much. I think that we are well educated for this evening, me and my Law Focus listeners. That was Ms. Peta Josephine from the Department of Justice educating us on the amendment of the Maintenance Act, that which has come into regulation and this January 2018. You're still listening to Law Focus. Let's go to the ad break.
Law Focus on Bafang 88.1, point of information.
Welcome back to Law Focus, your point of legal information. This is the show where we bring you legal arguments straight to your ear, more like the legal bench. Nonetheless, we have a lawyer on the line to come and tell us about the Maintenance Amendment Act. On the line, we have Ms. Joy van der Heide, who is an attorney practicing at Shoot Inc. Welcome to the show, Ms. Van der Heide.
Thank you. You can call me Joy, Basil.
Oh, okay.
It's so much easier.
Okay, how are you, Joy?
I'm good. No complaints on yourself?
Look, we are looking into this matter, and I think if I have a complaint, my complaint lies in the paper that you wrote. And my complaint is a very good complaint, and that requires more knowledge from you. I mean, you're saying that justice delayed is justice denied.
That is correct.
Can you please explain to us why are you, in your discussion, referring to this Maintenance Amendment Act as something that could be a burden?
Look, the new amendments to the Maintenance Act is a wonderful thing. So I'm not sure how much you've explained to your viewers, but there are three main amendments that's been brought in. Okay.
Yeah.
The one is that the person, cell phone provider can now track them on their cell phone and obviously also have been blacklisted. The maintenance officer can have been blacklisted. And, you know, these two big technological and advancements of these amendments is a wonderful thing because it will help bring maintenance defaulters to the table to actually say that they have to take responsibility for paying their maintenance towards the children. But the disadvantage, the only disadvantage, and this is where the justice delay, justice denied comes in, is that the Department of Justice do not have the resources or the personnel to implement. Staff is already overworked. You can ask anyone that goes to a maintenance court for assistance in obtaining maintenance for their children. They have to go through a process that continues for years. And while the department says that, you know, first applications, they are able to finalize within 90 days, which is great. Absolutely great. But now you finalize it, you get a court order. That's what they need. You get a court order for maintenance. But now enforcing the court order is where the problem lies.
Yeah.
Because they do not have enough personnel or enough finances to see it through.
Interesting, because the Department of Justice actually has an alternative argument for that. They actually argue that with these amendments, they've actually sped up the process, meaning that people don't have to go through those long processes. Right now, what can be offered is, for example, they don't need court orders for certain maintenance orders that which can be prompt. But what I also pick up from your argument, especially when you start saying that justice supply is not meeting justice demand, you're saying that, besides the fact that they have a thinly stretched budget, you're also arguing that approaching the court for financial assistance and paying for these cost implications may not be feasible. And so we ask this question I mean, give me a chance for this, because it's a very interesting part. So I asked them a question about this, and I said that, so how are they going to cover costs? About costs that which will be paid to the service providers in the electronic space, and they said that they will be paid by the court, but later on they'll be recovered from the defaulters themselves.
That is highly unlikely. Let me tell you why. Because people that are defaulting on maintenance tend to one cannot afford maintenance in the first place, so they're not going to be able to pay back the cost of the service provider in tracing the whereabouts and providing an address to the department, simply because that's R100 out of the child's mouth. So it doesn't make sense to recover it from them. The other thing is, you know, it would have been easier if there was an amendment, a further amendment brought, which said that the service provider has the right to deduct the fee on that person's cell phone account over a period of time, say over the time of the contract or over the time of that month if they are on a airtime, you know, when you're purchasing airtime scheme. So that would make more sense to me, because then at least the person's not feeling it immediately, it's being deducted over a period of time. So it makes the impact of that amount, that lump sum just being deducted or recovered from them, so much easier. The challenge that I have about the department is saying at the moment is that obviously they're saying that, oh, they finalized it in 90 days and it's so quick and it's so easy. But ask any person that's been at a maintenance court. They are usually understaffed. The staff have so much stress on their shoulders and they're doing more than one person's job to the point where they are actually despondent and they're not pleasant when working with the public. And I can't fault them, because anyone that's overworked and underpaid will eventually become disgruntled, unfortunately. The department currently is not able to resource the maintenance section and the family court section of their department, simply because of the total ban on further employment of staff by government, which was announced by the then financial minister, Nene, back in 2014. You will recall that, you know, there was a blanket sort of ban that no government department must employ further people. So what's been happening is you have a brain drain. So people are leaving the department and they can't fill the gaps. So unless there is a national policy put in place to say that the family courts can now employ people and hire enough staff to sort to actually meet the demand, you know, you're sitting in a catch-22 situation here, where you have these people go, it's nice to have, but it can't be implemented.
I mean, yeah, I understand that you are placing most of the argument on the weight of resources, that there are no resources, the government is understaffed, and so because there are no resources, the process takes longer. I think that's where you are sitting right now with your argument.
That's where I'm sitting, but also what I'm saying is that at least it's open for abuse as well, if you're reading the article. Why does it leave itself open up for abuse? Because if someone gets blacklisted, if I, for example, I go to a court and I say, I have a child with this man and he's not paying maintenance, and I report him, okay? And I get a court order, and for some or other reason, say he pays me cash instead of paying in my bank account, and we have a fight about something and I decide at his fight, I'm going to go report him for defaulting. The way the legislation currently reads, he can be blacklisted. There isn't a further inquiry process that's being followed before the blacklisting. You and I both know that blacklisting someone in today's time and age, especially with seeker rules in play, it's got huge constraints on their finances and their creditworthiness, and their credit, you know, and how do they then access funds for purchasing a car or buying a house or getting basic credits, which they might need for buying school books for the children or clothes for the school. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it really, the department, while it's a nice to have, they really need to sort it through properly and make sure that the amendments that were in place weren't open to abuse. Currently, as it stands, in my opinion, it's open to abuse.
So this particular deterrent that which has been introduced can actually turn into a weapon. That's your point.
Exactly.
So
unless the department then further amendments to actually put steps in place to regulate how they're going to be doing the blacklisting, firstly. And secondly, they need more staff and they need more money in order to implement.
So would it make a difference if they were going to blacklist once they've made a finding?
It would be a different case, because then at least there can be an inquiry process to see whether there is some sort of justification in the complaint, instead of just taking the woman's word for it that, oh, he's in arrears and therefore he must be blacklisted.
Yeah, because, you know, what we picked up from the Department of Justice is that they take quite a judicial arbitral approach to the situation. So they keep on saying that if maybe a father is aggrieved by the blacklisting and it puts them in a worse position, they can actually go and appeal the process. And so what seemed to be an issue from the position of Law Focus was that, but now what about a father who doesn't...
The difficulty with what you're saying is the following. You can't appeal the process, you can review it. And that is at the High Court. And who's got money to go to the High Court to review a process?
Yeah.
This is not someone that's in maintenance court. How do you then enforce your rights? So legislation has to protect people in general. It's not. I'm not advocating for defaulting at all, but what I'm saying is you have to protect people, because you have to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. So how can you implement a sentence like blacklisting without going through a process to see if he should actually be blacklisted?
So you are arguing that actually this legislation could be struck down as procedurally unfair?
Well, you know, that's that's the issue right now. And we had this debate on Kaya FM, I think it was, with the deputy minister, and I pointed this out. And the deputy minister was, at that stage, quite adamant that it won't be open to abuse and that they will make sure of that, etc., etc. And while it's great to have, I think that it needs to be clarified in the in terms of an amendment, a further amendment to the Act.
Mm. Or maybe in the regulations.
Or maybe in the regulations, which will also be an amendment. So, you know, but there has to be some amendment done in order to put processes in place. Currently, as it stands now, it's a grey area.
Mm. Because you also quote the Children's Act and in conformity with the Constitution, that the child's rights are actually of paramount importance whenever these kind of cases.
That is correct.
Yeah, and I understand that in most of your argument you actually place most of the weight on that issue.
Yes, because a child is entitled to both parents.
Mm.
Now, how can both parents provide for their child if you're limiting the ability of the one in obtaining credit? So, you know, it's a very fine argument to make. It's very much a grey area. Not until the department actually puts regulations in place, you know, by a further amendment.
But let's stretch it further. Let's go back to the geopolitics of this country. What about a situation where you have a father who is actually absconding their responsibility? Would that situation also apply to that? Your argument that you are placing a burden on someone who wants to be a part of a life. This person chooses not to be a part of this life, and that's why this mother is actually bringing him to the maintenance court. Now, would that maybe change the scales a bit for you?
It won't change the scales a bit for me, simply because, I mean, I know a lot of fathers that actually want access to their children, and a lot of fathers that want to be there for their children, but they're being blocked by the mother for various reasons, because of anger and hurt that they felt within their relationship.
Mm.
But even as it may, it doesn't sway. For me, the main thing is, and the main objective is, the best interest of the child. And it cannot be in the best interest of the child to limit the one parent's ability to obtain credit in order to support that child if needs be. And, you know, and if a parent doesn't want to have contact with that child, you can't compel the parent to have contact with the child. But at the end of the day, that child is going to come knocking on your door when you're an adult, and you're going to have some explaining to do.
You know, I would love to take this conversation further because I'm enjoying it. That is Ms. since you said I must call you Joy, who is an attorney practicing at the Shute Inc., specializing in family law and children's rights. And her argument is that the government must uplift the blanket government job freeze and provide sufficient budget to the Justice Department, and also deal with the issue of how this blacklisting can actually be abused. I think I've summarized your argument very well.
Yes, that is correct. Thank you, Basil.
Thank you for your contribution this evening.
Law Focus, handing you your rights.
Welcome back to Law Focus, your point of legal information. Essentially, maintenance cases are about providing the child with protection. You understand? Providing the child with a socioeconomic right. So using civil law to provide the child with a socioeconomic right. On the line, we have Ms. Pauline Manaka, who is an associate right now with the Cliff Decker of Mayor in the Dispute Resolution Practice Department. Before that, she was with the Knowles Hossein Lindsay Incorporated Attorneys, and that is when she wrote a very interesting paper where she spoke about this particular act that we're talking about today. Before it became an act, it was a bill at the time, and she spoke about the burden that it places on employers. But without going further into it, let me welcome you, Ms. Manaka. Welcome to the show.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm still okay. We are discussing quite a heated debate.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Unfortunately, I haven't been listening. I just got back home from the office, so I've missed out on the heated debate.
Yeah.
But you can just fill me in a little bit, yeah?
Yeah. So we are talking about the maintenance bill. I mean, the act. Currently, it's an act now.
Yes.
Which
it's
was passed
in January 2018. Yes.
Yeah, so it was passed in January. And it places quite an interesting array of of issues, and one of them is that it aims to blacklist defaulters of maintenance.
Yes.
So one of the things that you highlighted, which were very interesting for me, is the kind of burden that it places on employers of these defaulters and maybe other third parties. Please share that with us. What was the view there?
Yes. So at the time where I wrote the article, I think you had the bill that was just sort of out, and usually the way bills are drafted, it's very rough, and you're looking at all these clauses and you're trying to figure out which are the most important clauses, which will have, you know, the biggest impact moving forward. And I think what we can, and I'm sure you guessed in the debate, whatever you guys have been debating on, you can agree that the main aspects that have come out of the act and the impact are, number one, that no longer can a maintenance clerk issue an emolument. And that's a huge feature, I think, of what I was trying to get from what I was trying to say in my article at the time.
Yeah.
And the blacklisting issue, which, you know, I use the word controversial, but it is controversial because on the one hand, you're saying these people are unable and have difficulties in terms of providing maintenance, but at the same time, we're going to blacklist them and make sure that they can't get any credit.
Mm. Please elaborate on that. Let me press on you, Pauline, before you get to your last issue. Please elaborate on the aspect where you're talking about how controversial it is. And I see that you are pressing on it, but I want you to go deeper on it. Because we are talking about fathers who cannot afford to take care of their children, or so they say, because they keep on defaulting on their maintenance. But right now they're being blacklisted, and now they cannot access credit. I mean, what are the implications there for the child?
Well, I think this is you have to look at it from a public policy. So look at it from a faraway angle. The faraway angle is that, in general, people are probably have too much access to too much credit and fall into too much debt too quickly. So in the long run, and in the longest in practice, in terms of data control and getting money from debtors, placing people on a blacklist has in a way acted as a deterrent for that person to fall into further debt. I think number one, that's always the backdrop of why you'd blacklist people. It puts you in a place of discomfort. It makes you take steps to hopefully take control of your budget and your debts and deal with it accordingly. Now, imparting that into this maintenance issue and making it sure that fathers and or even mothers who are failing to pay maintenance are blacklisted, I think it's difficult because, yes, we're saying on the one hand, it's possible that you're not going to be able to get credit, but on the other hand, it forces them to work with the budget and maybe take the steps to get the help they need. By that, I mean getting debt counseling. And taking steps to take control of the back of your budget, and rather than further extending yourself into debt, which at the end of the day means, okay, I got a 5,000 rand loan from PEP. I can maybe pay my kids, I don't know, their school fees for 1 year, but next year there's no money, or there's no money for food, or there's no money for, for school clothes. So instead of taking steps by entering debt counseling, where in that space, they help you create income for you, and they help free cash so that you can deal with your maintenance and your debts and your liabilities on a monthly basis instead of in just random, spots at the time. So it's a double-edged sword. On the one fact, it's limiting people's ability to access credit, and maybe that might have ramifications in terms of ability to meet some of the maintenance requirements. Like I said, paying a school fees deposit or something like that. But on the other hand, it's also pushing people. It's a deterrent. It's something that you don't want to happen to you. So start paying your maintenance. Pay a portion of it. Do something. Take steps so that you don't find yourself blacklisted, which then affects all other parts of your life.
And so on to your last issue. Okay, on to your last issue.
The other aspect, I think you guys have probably debated it as well, is it's supposed to be a positive aspect, and that is the new Maintenance Act says that the maintenance clerks, right, can access directly. Well, they're supposed to. I thought at the time it was direct, but it's not direct. They are able to track down defaulters. So what happens is
you know the name of the father of the child, and you sort of know where he said he was working, and you know the first 5 months he made payments or she made payments, but then they, you know, they stop, they go cold, and you can't get hold of them. But because of things like RICA and all these things, we all have to register. The Act now enables maintenance clerks to work together with the, I think they call the communications, electronic communications department.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me just use the word department to try and actually track these guys down. Now, again, this is supposed to be a good thing because it means that the person that's seeking maintenance takes a closer step to finding the person and determining, number one, whether the person is employed. And if they're employed, then you can take steps as necessary to try and get a garnisher on their salary or on their wages. But the difficulty is that the way that the new Maintenance Act is drafted is that it's not, it makes the cost of taking those steps to find those details, it puts the costs on the department. It puts the cost in the court. And, you know, so it's on the one hand, look, here's this thing. We will help you to track down these defaulters, but it might cost us 500 or whatever. So there's no budget for it, you know. So yeah. I think...
Because as we were speaking to Ms. Joy van der Heide, who's also an attorney in the space, she was speaking about how the maintenance court is actually quite understaffed and under-resourced. And because of that, she didn't see how this would be implemented. But now, when we're speaking to the Department of Justice, they actually argued that they would claim these finances, or rather recover these finances from the defaulters themselves.
Yes, that is possible, but then that's placing an extra burden. So we really spoke about two burdens. We spoke about, number one, I'm blacklisted and I can't, you know, I can't access credit to, you know, enlarge my pool of funds to pay my maintenance. In fact, I'm under debt counseling in order to, you know, free up money to maintain. And then on top of this, you're going to come after me with this defaulting thing. I think what should happen is that these departments should be working together. You know, so there's definitely a structural and logistical issue with the with maintenance in this country in terms of the understaffing of the departments. Example, I'm currently residing in Cape Town. I work in Cape Town, and I can tell you that the maintenance court in Cape Town has maybe two officers or one officer on duty for the whole week dealing with a number of cases. And so issues like that, structural issues that, and practical issues, you know, the law is great because it's there on paper and it's substantive and we can read it, but practically it's, you know, the departments aren't working together to find ways to actually cut down on costs or make sure that they can actually implement these things, then it's not going to happen, you know? It's still going to remain very difficult, although I think from my paper back then, as young as I was, I think there was a positive feel about the changes, and I think I still feel that way. I think I'm not sure if I'm happy about the emoluments and the fact that now maintenance clerks can no longer issue them, and it has to be done before magistrate court, because now it's a burden on a father or a mother who's looking to get an emolument order to now possibly have to pay for legal fees. You know, they have to go to legal aid or clinic and get an attorney involved in a process that I would have thought should actually remain attorney-free, you know, so that it's almost a process where it's a one-on-one with the public and you don't have attorneys, as in it doesn't have a burden of acquiring additional legal skills. But, you know, as it is, I understand that the Constitutional Court was trying to balance the rights of, you know, people who, you know, wages and salaries or just get deductions that they don't know about and don't see coming versus, you know, the rights of children.
Yeah. You know, thank you, Ms. Pauline Manak. I would love to take it further, but you've made some pretty interesting submissions there, speaking about how blacklisting works and how the emoluments work, and how you're also worried about clerks not being able to issue these orders. That was our interview with Ms. Pauline Manaka, who's an associate with Cliff Decker of Mayor and the Dispute Resolution Practice. Thank you for your contribution this evening.
Thank you. Cheers.
You're still listening to Law Focus.
Law Focus on Valfair 88.1, Point of Information.
It's still Basil Sherinda, your guardian of the law for the evening, and this was your point of legal information. Unfortunately, we have come to the end, although the legal information will still live with you forever. That is if it's legal enough. You know, this evening we spoke about a couple of things, and one of the far more important aspects that we've covered, or some of the intellectual property arguments, if I may say, is the argument that which is made by Joy. And she says that this blacklisting element can actually be abused, which is something that most were not aware of. What will the Department of Justice do about this? We also spoke to Ms. Beta Josephine from the Department of Justice, and she actually outlined what this amendment is going to do, what it's about. And one of the most important aspects that she also highlighted is how it's going to be speedy. It's going to be a speedy process, and how it's going to be about, it's going to bring make the child be the center of it all. People have expressed concerns. You know, Ms. Pauline Manaka actually expresses concern about how TLACS can now no longer issue maintenance orders. She speaks about emolument, and I think that there's still a long way to go, but we have made it somewhere. Because at least we have found a deterrent. People can't lie anymore, because right now there are third parties that which can communicate with. I mean, that's all we have this week on Law Focus. This is the show where we still try to touch on the law, to bring you the best legal argument that you can get, as you've witnessed this evening. Thank you for joining us. Please find us on social media at Vow FM. With the hashtag Law Focus. Our podcast will be available at vet.journalism.co.za shortly. Please join us again next week at 7 p.m. From my producer, Ms. Bulali Diakopu, from our technical production, Kutlwano Gwinchiserame, and from me, Basil Sherinda, it's law and it's serious. Good evening.
Law Focus, point of information. Bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
Law Focus Podcast.